My name is Bernard White. The name of this program is Wake Up Call. And coming up in a few minutes in Wake Up Call, we have three individuals that we want to present to you today. Ta-Nehisi Coates, Randall Robinson, former head of Trans Africa, and author of Quitting America, and James Baldwin. Stay tuned.
If the earth could fly away, could you see her flying straight through space and time, leaving all humankind behind? If she could fly away, if she could fly away, so far away. If the earth could run away, could you see her gathering all the trees and plants, all the animals, all the birds and fowl, every creeping thing? They have never been her foe, never harmed her blessed soul. If she could run away, if she could run away, so far away, then she'd be running for life. Oh, she'd be running for life, running for a blessed life. Oh, she'd be running for life. Oh, she'd be running for life, running for a blessed life. If the earth could up and walk away, could you see her calling for all the oceans and the seas, all the rivers and the streams, all the whales and fish, every reptile that exists? They have never been her foe, never harmed her blessed soul. If she could walk away, if she could walk away, so then she'd be running for life. Oh, she'd be running for life, running for a blessed life. Oh, she'd be running for life. Oh, she'd be running for life, running for a blessed life. If the earth could crawl away, could you see her moving on with a body withered down? She'd be struggling to be free, free from cruel humanity. If she could crawl away, if she could get away, so far away, then she'd be struggling for life. Oh, she'd be struggling for life, struggling for a blessed life. Oh, she'd be running for life. Oh, she'd be running for life, running for a blessed life. Oh, she'd be running,
News Network, I'm Baynard Woods. A new study out last week suggests that police body-worn cameras have little effect on use of force by officers.
This is the first methodologically rigorous study on the use of body cameras since their widespread adoption in the wake of highly publicized use of force incidents. The study began as Washington, D.C. rolled out its extensive body cam program, and the results come as a surprise even to the police chief, Peter Newsom. Newsom told NPR that the cameras helped bolster the public legitimacy of the police department.
And I think it's really important, you know, for legitimacy for the police department, which is really kind of the most important thing that we can have is our legitimacy.
But a Columbia Journalism Review investigation into the use of cameras in the aftermath of the Las Vegas mass shooting showed that the media is often gullible when it comes to body camera footage, allowing the departments to use them as PR. Federal prosecutors in the District of Columbia recently fought in court to keep body camera videos from coming before the public. They claimed it was to protect the safety of the officers, but many thought it was about protecting their public image. Some of the footage, like what you're seeing now, shows officers using pepper spray or throwing non-lethal grenades, often at peaceful protesters or passersby. Judge Lynn Leibovitz ruled that the videos, but not their audio, could be released. But the battle over the footage shows the extent to which law enforcement seeks to maintain control of this footage and the narrative. Baltimore, where citizen cell phone video captured officers putting 25-year-old Freddie Gray into a police van as he screamed, saw body cam footage as a response to the widespread problems with the Baltimore Police Department. And yet, recent videos have shown that the body cameras have changed police behavior in Baltimore, but not for the better. In more than one case, it appears police were planting drugs, though the department later claimed they were recreating their discovery of the drugs. But according to public defender Todd Oppenheim, it's hard to know the extent of what is happening.
It's still kind of like a young technology that the prosecutors are feeling out and we're feeling out. So we don't even know if there is like some more nefarious stuff going on.
Isabel Lippman, his colleague, sees the problem as more fundamental.
It's not so much that I think there's mass manipulation of the video. Maybe there is, but it's just when it gets turned on at all. I mean, why should it ever be turned off, except that we don't want to live in a society where every officer is recording you at every moment that he's on the street? But even the decision about when the officer turns on and turns off the video, I mean, I've had cases where it gets turned off right before the good stuff.
Prosecutors and activists have seen some positive results. Oppenheim and Lippman say they don't always just have to take the officer's word in court. And President Obama's 21st Century Policing Task Force, which promoted body cameras, cited an earlier study that showed a nearly 90% decrease in instances of use of force where body cameras were used. At the time, many activist groups called for more body cameras, but others have been suspicious of the idea of a technological fix and have seen it as a way to prevent true community-controlled policing, especially when it gives police more powers of surveillance and they control the footage. Payam Sarabi of the Baltimore Block, an activist group, explains his reservations.
We're skeptical. At that time was this new wave across the country where police departments were now in support of body cameras, but that came with certain conditions such as them being in control of what, you know, the policy and procedure would be around that. So when we understood that that's how they were approaching it, we kind of resisted it, saying that it's got to involve the public, that certain conditions, not just like a pilot where, you know, rookie officers are trying it, but, you know, the first officers to wear it would be officers with bad reputations that have multiple complaints or part of these units such as the special enforcement section that have killed numerous people like Tyrone West.
And often, when citizens do have an encounter with the police, they're unable to obtain their own body cam footage.
This last May, you found yourself in a position where you were in need of requesting body camera footage for a case that involved yourself. What happened that day first?
I was just heading back from work, and I drove upon a police shooting. And hadn't been the first time that I was at a scene like that, but once I realized I was there, I started doing what I usually do, which is just document the scene, pretty much conduct my own investigation. And as I was documenting, you know, police were trying to disperse people from everywhere. And once I tried to, you know, assert my right to document the scene and stand on the sidewalk, the officer didn't like it and immediately choke slammed me, you know, picked me up from the sidewalk, and dropped me in the middle of the street. And so I, you know, caught a couple charges, and initially I wasn't able to get the body camera footage because I didn't take the charges to trial. And only if you take the charges to trial are you able to get those. Since I did not, I had to wait until my charges were dropped a couple months later. And since then, it's been a back and forth battle about having the right request form with the right words in it. So I'm now waiting. It's been since May. It's October now. A long time.
So you just, as you were on your way over here today, you just finally, from this case in May, got an invoice from the city telling you that you had to pay how much for each bit of body camera footage?
Yeah, less than 30 minutes ago, as I'm driving down here to do this interview, I got an email from the police department saying that I gotta pay them $150, $50 per video. It could be more if it took more time for them to edit it. But they need $150 to show me the video of me getting my ass dropped.
For the Real News Network, I'm Baynard Woods with Bashi Rose.
I'm joined down by Ta-Nehisi Coates, national correspondent for The Atlantic and author of the new book, which is out right now, We Were 8 Years in Power, An American Tragedy, which is a phenomenal read that you should definitely pick up. I'm looking at your facial expression while watching me recounting this. What's going through your head?
I'm literally speechless. I'm not speechless from the fact of learning the information. I'm speechless that we needed this. And I'm not trying to poo-poo the reporting, which was excellent, needed to be done. But is this really surprising? They are who we thought they were. This accords with everything else we knew about Donald Trump, everything else we knew about Steve Bannon. I think there's a group of people who have tried to willfully delude themselves about the nature and want to tut-tut and, you know, have really thin conversations about what is white supremacy and what is not. I don't know what else we need. I don't know if we need Steve Bannon to actually lynch somebody on the White House lawn to get the message. But it seems pretty clear to me.
One of the things that comes through in this article, and I thought about it in reference to the First White President essay that you published recently, which is one of the essays that's collected in the book, is their awareness that there is power in the thing they are cultivating.
And they're right. They're correct.
Well, I mean, they know that there are clicks, there's
right.
audience, there's
right.
energy,
right.
there's passion, there's right. some fuel.
Right.
And that's part of why they're going to it,
right.
because that's where the energy is. And at the same time, they recognize they're playing a dangerous game.
Right.
Which is trying to channel that fuel, but make sure that you can stay disassociated enough for plausible deniability.
Right, because there's another section of Americans, obviously, and some of them within the Republican Party who, you know, would be completely appalled at the explicit, you know, alliance with racists and white supremacists. But it's been pretty clear. I mean, when he was a candidate, the president of the United States said of a judge officiating over his case, he's a Mexican.
He can't judge me.
He can't because he's a Mexican. You know what I mean?
Right.
I just don't know how more explicit we can get here.
You know, one of the things, one of the themes in the essays and in your writing is about sort of white supremacy and racism in terms of anti-blackness, mm-hmm. specifically in the way that was built up. Mm-hmm. And there's a whole sort of political history of the ways in which that played out in crime and the way we dealt with crack epidemic mm-hmm. and Willie Horton ad and mm-hmm. things like that. What do you make of the fact that blackness is not the primary target of this kind of politics these days? Or often, if not, if it is the primary, it is along with Muslims
yeah.
and immigrants who are also very much the target.
I don't know how different that is. You know, when Al Smith ran for president and he went, you know, into the South, Al Smith obviously, at least white by our terms.
Right.
I mean, they burnt crosses. You know, there's always been...
Because
he was Catholic. There's always
right.
been an anti-Semitic element
right.
to white supremacy. You can, you know, go back into, you know, and find cartoons from the 19th century just after enslavement and see simian images of Irish Americans equated with black people. That's not to diminish, you know, the fact of it, but there's always been, you know, other folks, other groups that were along with black people in terms of being the victims and the targets of white supremacy.
One of the things that I think of is what's taboo and what's not, mm-hmm. right? So the Sig Hail salute is taboo,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, you just can't. I mean, they get my favorite part of that story is they get kicked out of the bar
right.
in Dallas.
Right.
can't go around. That's not, you know,
right.
When you see that in your bar, you say, get the heck out of my bar.
Right.
Right. Saying that is the only good thing that Islam has done for the country is 9/11, or the only thing that Islam has done is 9/11, or that all Muslim, all mosques are a factory of hate. That is the uncomfortable truth. Is that a decidedly less taboo in American life?
It's acceptable. You know, it's a different line. And I don't know if that has to do with the relationship between, you know, criminal acts and history. For instance, the Holocaust is not on the guilt.
Right.
You know, it's not on the conscience of Americans. And so we have a much easier time finger waving about that, as opposed to the proximity of history with, you know, 9/11. And so that's a different thing. People feel more justified in their bigotry, you know, perhaps. But it's quite clear that's not a line that, you know, that there's no line in terms of, you know, forbidding folks to, you know, use that sort of language.
One of the arguments I think you've made is, you know, that the taboos have been knocked away, that the subtext has become the text. The quiet part is said loud in the era of Trump, and that's his power. What do you make of the people who say, I am a never Trumper and I condemn him when he says about Mexicans and condemn him when he does about Judge Curiel and condemn him with Charlottesville, but I remain a Republican and I'm a conservative?
Well, I applaud the condemnation. I would say it's a little late. I don't think Trump emerged out of nothing. I would ask where these people were when Barack Obama was forced to hold up his birth certificate. I would ask where these people were when, you know, just hate mongers like Pam McGeller were spewing absolute nonsense about the mosque, and, you know, the 9/11 mosque. I would ask where these people were during when this whole idea of Sharia law was being made some sort of issue. This is built on a long history. Donald Trump didn't come out of nowhere. I mean, I could take it all the way back and say, you know, where were these people during the day of Willie Horton?
Right.
Because the Republican Party has been playing with fire. There's some sort of synergy in watching, or some sort of synchronicity in watching how Steve Bannon is sort of playing, you know, with these haters who are beyond the line, and how the Republican Party has historically played with racism, trying to, you know, just saddle right up to the line.
And also the way that he sicked it against them. And, and in some ways, a data point I think is interesting. So you got Bannon, you got Moore, then you got the race down in Virginia with Ed Gillespie.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Ed Gillespie was on the opposite side. For Roy Moore was the insurgent candidate,
right,
and he ran against Luther Strange. You beat him. Ed Gillespie was the establishment guy,
right,
and he was running against the wingnut, who is Corey Stewart, who was Mr. Confederate Heritage.
Right.
And Ed Gillespie won, and I want to take a look. This is the kind of ad that Ed Gillespie is now running as the establishment Republican candidate. Take a look.
MS-13's motto is kill, rape, control. This violent gang has been tied to brutal murders across Virginia. Ralph Northam's policy? Northam cast the deciding vote in favor of sanctuary cities that let illegal immigrants who commit crimes back on the street, increasing the threat of MS-13. Ralph Northam, weak on MS-13, putting Virginia families at risk.
Kill, rape, control, and then you've got the president today saying Ralph Northam, who's running for governor, is fighting for the violent MS-13 killer gangs in sanctuary cities. Vote Ed Gillespie.
Yeah, it looks really familiar. And the need to place this kind of racism, this kind of bigotry, this kind of white supremacy solely on the shoulders of this insurgent alt-right ignores the fact that the table was prepared, you know, over the course of years by the mainstream establishment Republican Party.
What about the Democratic Party?
Well, the Democratic Party has its history, too. There's a long history, which I've outlined in my work.
Yeah.
You know, certainly going back to Roosevelt and so on. No one is immune to it. You know what I mean? It's just that we're at this moment of politics right now, and have been, you know, at least since the civil rights movement, where one party in particular has decided to run towards that and decide to extract its energy from that. That doesn't make the Democratic Party immune to any critique.
How important? I know that you have a sort of view of the power of this force, white supremacy in American politics, that sort of has a kind of continuity. How important is it for someone that runs a campaign like this to lose?
I'm only pausing on the question because I'm just going to confess that I'm not sure about this,
right,
because I haven't decided. Obviously, I would like that person to lose.
Right.
But I'm not sure whether the problem is that the actual candidate that decides to siphon off the energy, or the fact that the energy is there in the first place.
No, it's a good question. Ta-Nehisi Coates.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming through.
I think I want to start by telling you how I have come to this subject of reparations. It's been a life's journey. They put blinders on draft horses to make the horses less distractible, to make the horses more controllable. And in a figurative sense, when I grew up in the American South, in Richmond, Virginia, under total segregation, blinders were put upon us in our community. And that is, there were limits on what we were allowed to know about ourselves. And to the extent that we couldn't see very much to the left or to the right or to the back or to the front, African Americans were more controllable. I recall a saying that we had when we were growing up that was so popular in the United States. The old folk used to say from all the time, my parents included, from here to Timbuktu. And I had been taught to think so little critically that I had never asked about what the expression meant. I didn't know where Timbuktu was. I didn't even know that Timbuktu was a place. When I got to Harvard Law School, I was 26 years old. It was the first time I had ever sat in a classroom next to a white American. And I remembered being impressed about how wealthy the school was. Harvard is the oldest university in America, established in 1636. And it has become extraordinarily rich. It has an endowment now in excess of $20 billion. And I recall sitting in class, poor child from the South, seeing these oil paintings above the wainscoted, rich hardwood rooms of old, bewigged white men from the 17th and 18th century. And one was awed by it. This is Harvard. 30 years would go by before I was to learn that Harvard Law School was established and made possible by a man named Isaac Royall, who endowed the law school from the proceeds he had gotten from the sale of slaves on his Antiguan sugar plantation. Our forebears, with their appropriated labor, endowed Harvard Law School. Brown University is a very prestigious Ivy League school in the United States. The Brown brothers made their fortune building and sailing slave ships. They established a bank in Providence, Rhode Island, that was to become Fleet Bank, one of the largest in the United States. So much of America's institutional wealth has its roots in slavery. Aetna Life Insurance Company, the same story. The early buildings of Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. were constructed with slave labor by slaves from Louisiana who were labor sold to a plantation in another place. They were never paid. The United States Capitol. I remembered when I used to work there. And I walked through the rotunda time and time again. And I never looked up. And I remembered one day when I was writing Defending the Spirit, I went down to the Washington Mall, walked up and down the mall with my daughter Kalia when she was just a little girl. And we were in the rotunda, and around the wall of the rotunda is a hat band, a kind of frieze that depicts American history. And you will see everybody depicted in the frieze, except the people who built the Capitol of the United States. They were never paid. The stones were cut in Stafford, Virginia, and brought up the Potomac River by enslaved people. Atop the United States Capitol is a statue called, ironically, Freedom. It is a statue of an Indian maiden. It was made and cast in Bladensburg, Maryland, by slaves. Broken into parts, brought to the Capitol, reassembled, and hoisted to the top of the dome by our forebears. Until 1807, Britain, British businessmen, British merchants, British bankers, made unseemly sums of money from the slave trade. The royal family was largely financed by the slave trade. So much capital was accumulated by Britain from slavery that the Industrial Revolution, because of this in large part, was made possible. I have long time learned now, that what you don't know will kill you. They're the blinders on the draft horse. You're not supposed to see that way or that way. You're not supposed to look behind. You're not supposed to know. When we talk about reparations, or at least when I talk about reparations, I'm not talking about money. I'm talking about money, yes, but I'm not only talking about money. The money will run into the trillions when the calculation is done. But the crime is much larger than that. There is no worse crime than you can commit against a people than to strip them of the story of themselves. For if you don't know your past, you cannot see your future. From here to Timbuktu. I remember when I got to college. When I arrived at college, I don't think I'd had a teacher who said anything to us about Africa, anything to us about the slave trade, anything to us about our dilemma in history, anything to us about what we had been and what we were and how we came from there to this point. And I remember the professor, we were reading a book on Western civilization, and she asked the class, "Tell me, do you think the author is Catholic or Protestant?" And it was the first time any teacher ever said to us anything about the author. The words were on the page, and the page was gospel. She said, "All of this is subjective. You have to learn to think critically. You ought to know from reading the text what the disposition of the author is. Look behind the words." And so, from that point on, I began to develop an investigative curiosity about where we were and how we got here. It may be difficult for those who have not studied these things, given the blinders we've all been fitted with, to believe that in the 1200s, in the 1300s, if one looked at Europe, Africa, the Middle East, Asia at that time, no one would have guessed a few hundred years from there that Europe would be near the top or that Africa would be near the bottom. Timbuktu was the cultural an academic center of the known world. They were doing cataract surgery in Timbuktu in the 1300s. And I didn't know anything about it. To deny me that information is a crime against humanity. One of the things that America does well, and all successful societies do well, is that it incessantly celebrates itself. In world opinion, it is at the virtual bottom now because of Iraq and other things, in the regard of people who live around the globe. But to Americans inside America, there are no people on earth who practice more zealous self-love than do Americans. Virtually whatever we do is right and lovable because we're the greatest country on earth. And we get everybody else to believe it too. And so when you look at the mall, you will see not a brick, not a stone, not a monument that will betoken and remember slavery. Hazel and I were reading last week an editorial in the New York Times. Just vilifying Japan for not owning up to their use of Koreans during World War II for Japanese troops as sex slaves. And they said that Japan must apologize. America has never apologized for slavery. And you see, the consequences that the contemporary victims of it know they're in a dilemma, but they have no idea of how they got there. There was another piece in the New York Times last week. The United States has put in place very severe immigration restrictions that have caused immigrants from Mexico, migrants, farm migrants, to leave Colorado. And so the fields are full of corn and other vegetables waiting to be harvested. The Colorado State Correction System has put in place a program where prisoners in Colorado are to harvest these crops for 60 cents a day. It is a modern slavery. But if you can't projected from anything that happened before, you can't understand always what you are looking at now. Somewhere after the civil rights movement in America, those people of privilege who were in a position to benefit, people like myself, who had once been in the same boat with the trunk of the black community, left the boat, went out and up, and did well. And so now we can all look at Oprah as something we can and should become. We can look at Bob Johnson, who has, in my view, served us badly with the establishment of BET and BET's little children now across the Caribbean, named Tempo and other strange things that are destroying our young minds. But those people left the black community because they no longer had in common with those they had been in the boat with anything much anymore. And so the bigger part of the black community in America remained bottom stuck. And to some extent, I think people like me forgot about people like them. There are 2 million people in American prisons. Half of them are African Americans. America has 1/20th of the world's population, but 1/5 of the world's prisoners. 1 in every 8 prisoners in the world is an African American. This is modern slavery. Some might say, well, if they did the crime, they should do the time. African Americans commit 12% of the nonviolent drug offenses in the United States, but they constitute 75% of prison admissions for nonviolent drug offenses. A young African American who is convicted of a crime will serve exactly twice the sentence that a young white American will, convicted of the same crime. They're the people who are going to be harvesting the crops in Colorado for 60 cents a day. And so much of the problem with this are the dividers between us that cause us not to be each other's brother and each other's sister, so that we can't watch each other. You can't be concerned about things that you don't know about. And so freedom starts in here. We could get trillions of dollars from reparations, but if we can't fix ourselves in here, the money will do us no good. And so when people ask me about, well, I must say, I've learned to deal with this now. When I used to work on South Africa issues, people used to say, well, we got problems over here. Why should we be concerned about problems over there? Mr. Robinson, you're not a South African. And I would say, but I am a South African. When I went to jail at the Nigerian embassy, I said, but you're not a Nigerian. I am a Nigerian. I am a member of the African world community, and there are no borders that divide me from the rest of it. Mr. Robinson, why would you move to St. Kitts? I am a Kittitian. I'm at home, and it doesn't make any difference the front on which I am fighting at any given time, because it is one fight, not several. I saw in the paper today, and I don't understand the details and I didn't read it, and there's similar things happening across the Caribbean, that two Haitians had been deported. I think one of the greatest crimes against our people has to do with how little we've been allowed to know about how much we owe the Haitian people. Toussaint Louverture, Jean-Jacques Dessalines, and a group of former slaves did what no other enslaved people anywhere in the world had ever done before and has been able to do since. And because of what they did, they have been caused to pay a price like no people on earth have been caused to pay. And because we have been fitted with the blinders, we have not been able to see what they did for us all. Napoleon Bonaparte wanted to expand his Louisiana territory westward to the West Coast. He had ambitions of world empire. And he wasn't able to do that largely because Toussaint Louverture and Jean-Jacques Dessalines and these slaves defeated France twice. 60,000 person armies commanded by Napoleon's brother-in-law. Military genius Louverture was. And then defeated the armies of France, of Spain, and England. And made them turn tail to run back to Europe and put in place the first free black republic in the world, and then open their doors to slaves, runaway slaves from anywhere in the world. You come to Haiti, you are a citizen. And then gave Simone Bolivar who was trying to liberate Latin America. All the guns and all of the ammo and all of the explosives and all of the everything he needed. And that's why a Haitian president's bus sits in the legislature in Caracas, Venezuela. Because Venezuela is a free country today. Because of what Haiti did for it. I don't know if you know who John Brown is, but John Brown is an American who made war against the United States government before the Civil War, trying to free the slaves. And for his trouble, he and his men, two of whom were black, were executed, hanged. We got a lot of Booker T. Washington high schools in America. There are no John Brown high schools. But John Brown was a great man, a white preacher, who died for his beliefs that slavery was a moral wrong. In Haiti today, a main thoroughfare is named John Brown Avenue. And when he died, the flags in Haiti flew half-mast. These terribly creative people who remember Africa more than any other Africans in the diaspora. They remember it in their sayings. As they say, the axe forgets, but not the tree. They remember it in their language. They remember it in their religion, that the world has taught even us to ridicule. It's amazing power of information, how they can turn people against themselves. We used to run away from slavery in the United States to Indian tribes that gave us refuge. There were five tribes, Seminoles and Choctaws and Chickasaws and Cherokees. Five tribes they called in America, where the people learned to call themselves the civilized tribes. And they were called civilized tribes because they too enslaved African Americans, because they were trying to mimic what their southern white neighbors had done. You see, so out of this reparations business, out of this question, out of this exploration, out of this inquiry, out of this critical thinking, we will be victorious if we do nothing more than discover ourselves. You see, in America, we have tons of films on the Holocaust. We have tons of films on this, tons of films on that, reams of magazine stories about Rome and Greece and the ancient times and all of that, on and on and on, much of it fictional. Christ depicted as a blonde white man with blue eyes, which was not possible in that part of the world at the time. But we have been taught to believe it. And we don't realize that in the acceptance of much of the information, we also learn to hate ourselves. We have a story, we have a history that is as glorious as any people's on earth. Danny Glover tried so hard to put the money together to make the film of Toussaint Louverture. Who's going to put up the money? The film never got made. He who pays the piper calls the tune. We've got to find a way to do the things we believe in. We've got to learn what it requires to be an independent thinking people. We have to develop inside our ranks our own point of view. You see, anytime you take a people and you make them into a shadow of what they were, it took our religion. It took our languages. It took our mothers. It took our fathers. They took our names. They took our memories. They took our cultures. They took our mores. They took our insides. And they made us into people centrally proud of our cell phones. People who are in love with things. One of the great viruses, I think, infecting the West is that we've all become to be lovers of things. Nothing wrong with things. You know, I have no particular commitment to thinglessness, but there has to be something more. You see, it has a lot to do with how people are made resilient. One of the problems that the U.S. is having in the Middle East and in Iraq is that they didn't know it in their arrogance when it started. But they are dealing with people who remember who they were. The people who taught the world to read and write. A culture 7,000 years old, and its children remember it well. We need to put great investment in this. You see? And so much of it has to do with education. Because it seems to me that when you, out of this, give young people a purpose. I remembered when I was going to college, I went on a basketball scholarship. When I was in high school, I was very, very, very cool. I was a big basketball star. And somewhere around the time of my maturation, I learned that it didn't make much sense to run up and down a court one way and then the other way. Although it was fun, it had little to do with anything of any consequence. That I needed to find some answers to some questions. And so I have found too often in our schools across the world, as they used to say to us in our schools in America, our own teachers, I got mine, you got yours to get. It's the way I see these prisoners locked up in these jails. How can I be disengaged from them? They are the future of the black race in America, and they have to be salvaged. There, but for the grace of God, go I. We are the same people. And so we have to encourage, we need a zeal, we need a new catching kind of phenomenon where our teachers come to believe that there is no greater purpose than you can serve than to be a teacher of children. And not just the ABCs, not just the 1, 2, 3s, but asking them to think and to explore and to investigate and to know. Asking them to find out something about Monomotapa in ancient Zimbabwe. asking them to know about the great kingdom of Mali, asking them to find out something about the Benin in Nigeria, asking them to find out something about Africa in the glory of its antiquity, when it was second to no place in the world. Verifiable history. You see, a lot of things that people say about the history is, if not made up, embellished. Discovery Channel went to the Sinai Desert and could find nothing to verify that Moses had wandered in the desert. That's not to say he didn't, but there's no archaeological evidence to demonstrate that he did. It is not important to demonstrate it as long as the people who need to believe it, believe it. And they believe it because it's important to us. When you walk on the mall, I don't know how many of you have seen that big statue of Abraham Lincoln sitting in the chair. People come from all over the world to see that thing. And you see Americans there. I once saw a couple from Nebraska. I could tell because they had funny shorts on and a dangling camera. I said they must be from Nebraska or Idaho. And they were leaning against each other. And they were transfixed. They were mesmerized. They were practicing ancestor worship. And they were doing it because they needed to do it. You can't be a whole person unless you know your history and you revere your ancestors. And so when one thinks about why all the monuments in Washington, why all the tablets, why all the magazines, why all the statues, why all of this, it is so people will never forget that their society is old and productive. And so when we have children in our schools that are not doing well, we have to learn to look at those children as the future of our world. And the good teacher sees potential in that child and loves that child. And the healthy society tells the teacher that we value you, teacher, because you are more important than anybody in our society for helping us to make a future. If we don't salvage these children, we'll be running from them later. They're our children. We cannot disengage. They're our future. And to some extent, when you tell them who they are, you'll see set afoot a new child with a new pride and a new sense of possibility. So when one talks to me about reparations, I've heard a lot of questions that sound like questions I might have asked when I wore the blinders. That was then, this is now. Who's going to get a check? Does Oprah need a check? On and on and on. It's not about the money. It is, but it is not. America has paid reparations to virtually everybody. But the group to which it cannot even rise to make an apology to. And so we have to be informed and implacable. We have to do it not just from those of us who are organizers, those of us who are agitators like myself. We have to do it from those of us who wear suits and ties to work every day, from engineers and from lawyers and from the Hollywood money people, from our actors, from our performers. We have to do it with a common voice. It only makes sense. If you enslave a people and you steal from them the value of their hire, and you take the appropriated value of that hire and you bank it, and then you watch it grow over a century and a half, and then you see these great money families who buried the trail behind them of their success. And then you see these people in prisons who are the descendants of those who produced the wealth for these. Isn't it reasonable if somebody took something from you to ask for recompense? I don't think it's unreasonable. It's been done for virtually every put upon group in the world. Why was Aristide abducted by the United States and taken to the Central African Republic? France never forgot what Toussaint Louverture and Jean-Jacques Dessalines did to France. Aristide never forgot it either. He and Haiti attempted to challenge the very wealthy so that they would make better terms available to the very poor. France is the only case where, after a people won and defeated his nation, he imposed reparations, saying that the people had to pay France for having freed themselves. Haiti paid France, in today's dollars, $21 billion. Didn't finish paying for it until 1947. It is in large part why Haiti is poor today. And so it was Aristide who said to France, it is time to talk about paying Haiti back the money that was extorted from it by you. It was then that France hardened its commitment with the United States to overthrow the democratic government of Haiti. What you don't know will kill you. Information is power. And so we're not talking about a few people. We're not talking about elitist information. We're talking about common information so that all of our children will have it. Let's teach them the things that are relevant to our time and to our mission. I can't think of anything more important than what you're doing now on this question of reparations, because it will produce benefits that you can't even envision now. We will see children who will have lights in their eyes that we haven't seen for a long time. They will study harder. They will work harder. They will reach further. They will be empowered. And they will serve us time immemorial. And we must remember, in the making of this struggle, that all of our struggles everywhere won. That from Harlem to Johannesburg, from Nairobi, Kenya to Bastia, St. Kitts, from Antigua to Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. We must remember always, always, for the sons and daughters of Africa, that the blood that unites us is thicker than the water that divides us. Thank you very much.
I'll tell you a story, if I may. Many years ago, when I first came to London, I was in the British Museum, naturally. And one of the West Indians who worked there struck up a conversation with me and wanted to know where I was from. And I told him I was from Harlem. And that answer didn't satisfy him. And I didn't understand what he meant. I was born in Harlem. I was born in Harlem Hospital, I said. I was born in New York. None of these answers satisfied him. He said, where was your mother born? And I said, she was born in Maryland. And I could see, though I didn't understand it, that he was going more and more disgusted with me. He was so became more and more impatient. And where was your father born? My father was born in New Orleans. Yes, he said, but man, where were you born? And then I began to get it. No, I said, well, I said, my mother was born in Maryland, my father was born in New Orleans, I was born in New York. He said, but before that, where were you born? And I had to say, I don't know. I could see that he did not believe me. And I tried to explain, there's no way for me. He said, don't you care enough to find out? And I tried to explain that if I were originally from Dakar, from wherever I was in Africa, I couldn't find out where it was because my entry into America is a bill of sale. And that stops, that stops you from going any further. At some point in our history, I became Baldwin's nigger. That's how I got my name. Now, that really cannot be considered, my fault. It can't be considered the fault of the cat in the British Museum either that he doesn't know that I can't find that out. And I tell you that story to dramatize the nature of the distance created deliberately. Because when I became Baldwin's nigger, it's also very important to point out, I was handcuffed to another man from another tribe whose language I did not speak. We did not know each other. And we could not speak to each other because if we could have spoken to each other, we might have been able to figure out what was happening to us. And if we could have figured out what was happening to us, we might have been able to prevent it. We would have had, in short, a kind of solidarity, which is a kind of identity, which might have allowed us, which might have made the history of slavery very different. History of slavery in the North American continent, I mean. Well, that didn't happen, and here we are. One of the most terrible things, one of the most difficult things, because it is something which one has that wants to resist, as he has said, and also to use, is that in fact, whether I like it or not, I am an American. Now, that is not, I'm not Lyndon Johnson, and I'm not saying that as, I am an American. I don't mean that, no. Alas, I mean something very different. But I do mean that I was formed in a certain crucible, that my school really was the streets of New York City. My frame of reference was George Washington and John Wayne. but I was a child. When a child opens his eyes in the world, he has to use what he sees. There's nothing else to use. And you are formed by what you see, the choices you have to make, and the way you discover what it means to be black in New York. I don't know how you discover what it means to be black in London, but I know what it means, how you discover that in New York, and then throughout the entire country. And I know how, as you grow older, you watch in the richest city in the world, and the most famous, the richest, freest nation in the world, in the Western world. I know how you watch as you grow older, literally, and this is not a figure of speech, the corpses of your brothers and your sisters pile up around you. And not for anything they have done. They were too young to have done anything. In any case, too helpless. But what one does realize is that When you try to stand up and look the world in the face like you had a right to be here, when you do that, without knowing that this is the result of it, you have attacked the entire power structure of the Western world. If I, one fine day, discover that I have been lied to all the years of my life, and my mother and my father were being lied to, if I discover that in fact, though I was bred and bought and sold like a mule, but I never really was a mule, if I discover that I was never really happy picking all that cotton and digging in all those mines to make other people rich, and if I discover that those songs the darkies sang and sing were not just the innocent expressions of a primitive people, but extremely subtle and difficult, dangerous and tragic expressions of what it felt like to be in chains, then by one's presence, simply by the attempt to walk from here to there, you've begun to frighten the white world. They have always known that you were not a mule. They have always known that no one wishes to be a slave. They have always known that the bales of cotton and the textile mills and entire metropolises built on black labor, that the black was not doing it out of love. He was doing it under the whip. The threat of the gun, and the even more desperate and subtle threat of the Bible. Now, then, one is watching, according to me, in the streets of Southeast Asia, what must be considered as a final act of the white Christian European industrial drama. Speaking as an American, reading the news and looking at the pictures, the streets of Saigon resemble nothing so much to me as the streets of Detroit. And in both cities, precisely the same war is being waged. That war may yet spread to engulf the globe. And let's speak plainly. We know, everybody knows, no matter what the professions of my unhappy country may be, that we are not barbing people out of existence in the name of freedom. If it were freedom we were concerned about, then long, long ago we would have done something about Johannesburg, South Africa. If we were concerned with freedom, boys and girls would not, as I stand here, be perishing in the streets of Harlem. We are concerned with power, nothing more than that. And most unluckily for the Western world, it has consolidated its power on the backs of people who are now going to die rather than be used any longer. In short, the economic arrangements of the Western world proved to be too expensive for most of the world. And the Western world will change these arrangements. All these arrangements will be changed for them. This is what is beneath all the rhetoric and all those rather shameful speeches coming from my president. And this imposes on us, then, a very considerable burden. I, for example, do have, in principle at least, the choice of How can I put it? Becoming a good American. I can make a living. Yes, I could. I'm well enough known to be an ornament. In short, I could ally myself on the side of what I most seriously consider to be a criminal nation. But if I can't do that, then I have to examine all the reasons that I can't and find out in myself precisely the terms of my connection with other people. One has tried, I tried for a long time, in my own person, in, you know, in things I wrote and things I said. I don't mean that I was alone, but I'm using myself as an example. To convey to my countrymen, white and black, the nature of our danger and where we were going to go if we could not resolve the situation in our cities and in our streets, in our houses, if brother could not deal with brother, because on the American continent, they talk about the color problem, but the truth is that no white American is sure he's white. And every American Negro visibly is no longer an African. And we know what happened, and we know who had the whip. So it was not my grandmother who raped anybody. Well, if the day comes when you realize, and you don't want to realize it, that you cannot make yourself heard, that the people whom you are addressing a plea for them and for you, and the plea is a very simple one. It's saying, look at it. Forget all the mountains of nonsense that have been written and everything that's been said. Forget the Negro problem. Don't write any voting acts. We had that. It's called the 15th Amendment. You're in the Civil Rights Bill of 1964. What you have to look at is what is happening in this country. And what is really happening is a brother has murdered brother knowing it was his brother. White men have lynched Negroes knowing them to be their sons. White women have had Negroes burned knowing them to be their lovers. It is not a racial problem. It's a problem whether or not you're willing to look at your life and be responsible for it and then begin to change it. That great Western house I come from is one house. And I am one of the children of that house. Simply, I'm the most despised child of that house. And it is because the American people are unable to face the fact that, in fact, I am flesh of their flesh. Bone of their bone, created by them. My blood, my father's blood is in that soil. They can't face that. And that is why the city of Detroit went up in flames. And that is why the city of Saigon was under martial law. I know. There have been 400 years in that house. They do not know who I am, and I cannot marry their daughters or go to their churches. I would have to be a much more stupid man than I am to believe they know anything at all about those people in the Asian jungles. According to me, they liberated me before they got around to Asia, and it was liberation difficult to bear. Many didn't survive it. It seems to me, though, that the greatest difficulty that we face is, first of all, to excavate our actual history. And I am part of the history which occurred in the Caribbean. And you are part of the history which occurred in Harlem. And one's got to find the terms. One's got to accept that and find out how to use that. And one has got to decide, I think, that the actual and the moral basis on which the world we know now rests are obsolete, must be changed. Insofar as they're obsolete, they are wicked. And as far as they're obsolete, they are oppressive. It is simply not conceivable that for another 500 years or 200 years or 100 years, that the blacks of South Africa, for example, should live and die in the mines, being treated like animals to make other people rich. That is simply not the civilization which is doing this. By doing this, dooms itself. It is not possible to agree with it, nor is it possible to compromise with it. Freedom is a much overused word. And it may not be as real as slavery, which is a very concrete thing. But freedom is what one's after. And as it cannot, I suppose, be given, then it obviously must be taken. There are many ways to take it. But before we can discover this, we have to discover how to reunite ourselves, the terms on which we can speak to each other, the terms in which, in fact, put it bluntly, we can plot against the master. And lest anyone misunderstand me, I'm not really talking about color. I'm not talking about race. I don't really believe in race. I don't really believe in color. But I do know what I see. I do know that in the very same way that the American Negro situation menaced everybody in the country, and now it is visible. What happened in Detroit is perfectly logical, and the lesson is plain. What happened says, if I can't live in this city, you can't live in this city either. When a city goes under martial law, everybody in the city is under martial law. If I can't walk out and buy a loaf of bread safely, neither can the housewife. That's why she's on the range learning how to shoot a pistol. In the land of the free and the home of the brave. They're confusing themselves with the Indians. No, they're back at the wagon train. But we all know who's in the streets of America. We know who to whom we are referring when you talk about crime in the streets. We know the son of the president of Pan Am is not in the streets. Only one person in the streets. That's me. And they're plotting to shoot me in the name of freedom, dignified by law. And I'm supposed to agree. I'm supposed to agree. No, 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 sir. I won't be disorderly no more. Alas, the party's over. The question is, what shall we do? Everyone knows that the question's in everybody's lap, from Washington to London. To bomb. Everybody knows it. They're trying to figure out what to do. We should figure out what to do. Thank you.
There's a fountain of hope. Living water for each of us. There, rivers of dreams flowing through the heartache of this place. There are children that flower the trees. There are voices of people who need this place.
And this is CPRMetro.org, Community Progressive Radio. My name is Vernon White. The name of this program is Wake Up Call. Ooh, yeah. And until next time, Stay strong, pay close attention, and never give up.
Sorrow and sadness here, but there's heaven and sunshine too. The spirit of peace moves free and clear, making way for laughter here. There are children that flower the trees. There are voices of people who believe in this place. They live and breathe in this place, yeah. This place.